This podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome back once more to Candidate Confessional, the podcast that Donald Trump called the classiest podcast he's ever heard. I'm Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Cherkis. And I'm pretty sure he described it as a 3-star Sheraton.
That's fine, as long as it had, like, what, free Wi-Fi, continental breakfast?
It had memory foam, so it sounds pretty good.
That works for me. So for this podcast, listener, we want to take you back to election night 2008.
Believe it or not, the country had just elected its first African-American president.
Whoa.
Democrats were actually making gains in Congress.
Crazy.
And Washington was so excited there were drum circles on New Street.
I may have seen one of those drum circles.
I think you were dancing in them, like in the center.
I think you just revealed too much.
I did, sorry.
Okay. Now, even before Obama took office, you could sense trouble ahead, right? The economy was absolutely cratering, and he wanted a stimulus bill on his desk by the time he was in the Oval Office.
But Democrats didn't just want to respond to a crisis. They wanted to actually enact policy.
Exactly. They wanted to pursue health care reform and cap and trade legislation. It was an eventful, really a crazy 2 years. The question always was, could the party make it work politically?
I think the answer lies in your phrase, cap and trade legislation, which brings us to this week's guest, Tom Perriello.
Tom Perriello had been elected in 2008 in Virginia's conservative 5th district. Now, he was a Democrat, but really, he was an unapologetic progressive. And he had this crazy notion, right, that rather than moderate his positions, he was going to actually vote for things that progressives wanted and then go back home and defend the hell out of them.
And keep in mind, 2 weeks after he took office, Republicans were airing attack ads against him. But he still went back to his district, returning on weekends to persuade coal miners and conservatives about green energy jobs and the stimulus bill, and still having to deal with death threats over the health care bill.
It was a dark time for sure. But in short time, Perriello's election became sort of a test for Obama Democrats everywhere. Could they win by embracing the president rather than running away from him?
Beyond the bluster.
Behind the bunting.
Past the posters.
After the ads.
The campaign picks up.
And the motorcade moves on.
What happens when the votes are counted?
And democracy doesn't go your way.
This is Candidate Confessional, a HuffPost podcast.
I'm Sam Stein. Okay. I'm sorry.
Actually, I'm Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Cherkis.
And we approve this podcast. What we're going to do here is something a little bit different than what we normally do, which is we want to start with your win. We usually focus on losses, but I think it's important to understand your loss through the lens of your win in 2008. So tell us about that night where you emerged victorious, and tell us about your district a little bit, too.
Yeah. Well, in a way, we never really got the election night euphoria because we headed straight into a recount. we had which was fascinating because this historic moment's happening. Obama's getting elected. Virginia has gone blue for the first time since the Civil Rights Act had passed. And this was all going around us. And obviously, we were incredibly engaged with that. But CNN had actually called the race against me earlier in the night. And then they had to pull back the call. And so we were, you know, it was one of those things where you can be so exhausted because there's a finish line in place, and then you find out that the finish line just got extended a few weeks. I always think of it as being that scene in the Blues Brothers when they drive the car all over and they finally get to the tax assessor's office and the car falls apart into 1,000 pieces. That was meant to be us on election night, but then we found out we had to raise $100,000 for lawyers and get people out to 22 separate counties all by 6 a.m. the next morning to ensure that there was not some effort to play games with the vote and the recount. And that actually is a segue perhaps into the district itself, which is the size of New Jersey. I mean, it's a massive area in central and southern Virginia, and it's a bit of a microcosm of the United States because the northern part of the district, which includes Charlottesville and the University of Virginia, is very sort of mid-Atlantic, solidly blue area, a college town. Then you go down through the Bible Belt, literally Jerry Falwell's area and Liberty University. And then you move into essentially the Rust Belt, which is the old tobacco, furniture, and textile manufacturing part of Virginia, where you'd seen massive layoffs and outsourcing of jobs and extremely hard hit economically. So you got a fascinating cross-section of different politics, not just the traditional right-left, but some of what we now think of as sort of the populist to corporatist divide as well. And that didn't line up naturally with some of the partisan divide. So it was fascinating. You know, when I got in the race, we were 36% behind, I think, in the polls, 36 behind. And we went with a very grassroots heavy campaign. And 12 months later, I think we were only 32% behind. So,
How did you find when did the recount end? And what did you do when you were declared the victor?
Well, I was actually just thinking, there are very few things that I want to go back and relive from the political experience. But the next day, we actually did 5 separate press conferences in 5 of the media markets in the district. And I think in the first one, we were down 800 votes. And in the second one, we had gone to 300 votes and then 35 votes. And in the next one, I think we went up 4 votes. And then it went up there to about 700 vote margin, 727.
Think about just declaring yourself the winner after the fourth
one?
Oh,
we did.
4 votes?
Oh, of course we did. Yeah, we clearly won. And because we were up about 2,000 votes on election night. And then there'd been an error in one of the machines. And so we went down. So we just sort of stuck with the victory message from the night before. But
sure.
I'm quite confident my body language from those 5 press conferences probably changed dramatically, along with the bags under my eyes. So it was another few weeks of lawyers playing games and a few changes.
Because we had heard about an impromptu parade through Charlottesville.
And uncorking of champagne on the streets.
There were people who were pretty excited because your district had not voted for a Democrat in eons.
It was an interesting night in Charlottesville. I actually still remember because it was one of the first times I felt like a politician in the bad sense of the word, was that everybody wanted this rousing victory speech. And I knew privately that we were about to go down in the vote counts, but wanted to tell my supporters, give them the cathartic moment. This wasn't in front of cameras. This was out and about, and just sort of gave this rousing speech, completely acting like I was confident we were going to win, when in fact we were quite concerned. So it was an amazing feeling that night. It really was, and continued to be. The recount actually ended, this may be part of what you mean, ended up being finalized right around the time all the Christmas parades around the district were happening.
Okay.
So then I was going out and being in those parades. But it was a big deal to be represented. And keep in mind, the southernmost city in my district, Danville, was the capital of the Confederacy after Richmond fell. It was what Martin Luther King called one of the most viciously segregated cities in America. So for the African-American population of Southside, to see Barack Obama elected, to see him elected with votes from Virginia, and to see a congressperson who was fully embracing that and not pushing away at every chance to get, meant a lot. And I think one of the more significant things I did that you can't quantify was continuing to stand with him when his popularity plummeted.
Do you recall like a moment at that after your victory and you started going to the parades? Did you have like a "what do I do now" moment? Like, now I have to do the job that I was elected for.
Yes.
You were Robert Redford.
Yeah.
It was more or less a 24/7 state of mind there for a brief period of time, but. In a deadly serious sense, of course, we were headed into the worst economic crisis of modern history, and an area that was already economically hard hit. You were talking about hundreds of thousands of job losses across the country, people getting foreclosed on. And what people said to me about the 3 weeks of getting the stimulus together was that it was like an entire term of Congress in 3 weeks. And I had no reference point, but it ends up it really was like that. And so it's everything from like picking your staff and you know, figuring out where you're supposed to show up. And I literally had to scrounge around money to pay for the security deposit for my apartment up here because I'd spent everything that I had on the campaign. And I still have my student loans to pay and everything. So it was a crazy moment. I think it's also one of those first tests for people. Because everyone tells you essentially to fire your campaign staff. You've got to bring on professional campaign people. Don't bring your friends up with you. And like a lot of things in life, that's half true and half really, really bad advice.
I mean, you talked about this three-month legislative calendar where
– 3 week.
3 week, I mean, legislative calendar where the stimulus was passed. And here you are. You show up. You're a new guy already. Try to give us a sense of what – that climate was like, because I think people don't quite understand how tense it was.
It was insane. If you recall, President Obama, of course, has not been sworn in at that point. He doesn't get sworn in until the 22nd or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And he wanted the stimulus on his desk when he got sworn in. So basically, everything that put that together was taking place before he had formally taken office. They went up with negative ads against me already in that period of time.
2 weeks.
Yeah, two weeks. That's not bad,
what
right?
What were the ads about?
It was...
Had you already said something's dumb? Like, the gotcha?
A classic
like
gap. Yeah.
I'd started that process years ago. But no, it was really... I'm pretty sure it was about the stimulus and this idea that we were going to steal your money and spend it all on lavish palaces for Nancy Pelosi or something and treehorn frogs in the stimulus or something of that variety. And I think they made a correct Machiavellian decision that there was this extremely talented group of new people who'd come in, many of them not from traditional political backgrounds, and that if they had time to really get to know the voters as human beings, that would really lock in the benefits of incumbency. And they really went for the jugular early on that.
Did you realize that like right away when they did the tech ads? You're like, oh, they're trying to pin me down already. Not gonna let me.
It was not subtle. So, no. Yeah, I think...
Because most people would say, oh, wow, I'm a year in, 50 weeks from re-election here, that's a wasted attack ad. I mean, that's not worth any money because people forget about it. But it seems to, like you were saying, it was a tactical decision designed to just throw you off.
Well, I think this was part of a broader decision that Cantor and others made at the time, which was effectively a scorched earth policy against the president. Cantor had really learned this from the Mark Warner experience, right? So Mark Warner came in as governor of Virginia after a governor had blown a huge hole in the deficit, made it, all this sort of disastrous stuff. Warner comes in, cuts a deal with the Republicans, bipartisan deal to balance the budget, make Virginia the best managed state, best state in the country to raise a family and all of these incredible things. And Cantor's lesson from that was we can never let that happen again. Because, of course, the bipartisan support helped create Warner as a really untouchable force in Virginia politics for a while. And so I think his takeaway from that was you can never give this guy his historic opportunity to deliver on a bipartisan deal with these results.
So that's the climate before even Obama takes office, because these attack ads are being run. He's not even inaugurated yet. You're serving because Congress comes in earlier. How do you possibly craft a $850 billion stimulus in that?
Yeah. Well, and one last word on that and then about the stimulus was, at first we really had this hope that we were going to get along with the new Republican class as well. And they were really reined in from even talking to us. I mean, it was like the parents on the schoolyard saying you're not allowed to play with those kids or something.
Did you have members say I can't talk to you?
It was made clear. and, of course, the votes as well. I mean, there was basically when you think about the idea that the country was in total economic freefall. You had a president who had just been elected with a strong mandate, and you had a stimulus that by all accounts was a set of pretty Republican-friendly ideas. I mean, it was a third tax cuts that therefore – it was a third funding of unfunded mandates to the states, which they'd been railing about since the Newt Gingrich era, and a third originally infrastructure and research and development spending, which they said they were for. That part got cut back a lot, obviously. And I asked one of the leaders, I said, what could be in the stimulus – that would make you support it. It seems like these are pretty Republican-friendly ideas. And the person said, you're asking the wrong question. The question is if it works, Obama's going to get all the credit for it. And if it doesn't work, we don't want any part of it. And this was that Mr. Smith goes to Washington moment for me of like imagining – I know there's partisanship. But you really believe underneath it there's some statesmanship. There's some sense of a res publica, of a commitment to fixing the country. And to have that crass of a political analysis at that moment that they literally could not, even with the possibility of a depression at stake, rise above that to do what was good for the country. And it was – it just was spelled out to me very clearly early on. And the stimulus itself, there were really interesting debates to be had. They were – as you know, some of us pushed for what I would call a more transformative stimulus, one that if you basically felt like everything in the economy was working until 2008, then you just needed to jolt the economy back to 2008. If you believed that this had been a 20-year hollowing out to some extent of the middle class, growth of inequality, disappearance of work, at least living wage work, then the kind of stimulus you design is very different. There was a clear view from the White House of which one of those to do, which was partly about sequencing and other things. So, I mean, in some ways, it was a fascinating debate playing out.
Well, what
in real
was the
time.
Pushback when you said we needed to be more transformative? Was it just that we don't have time?
It was three or four different pushbacks. So there was the political reality issue, which said, you know, we need to get this through. And we are going to artificially say it has to be below $1 trillion, even though the economists say it should be $1.3 trillion. There was a sequencing argument that said, you know, this is going to be so popular and successful that we'll simply come back later for another tranche.
that didn't work out.
If needed, yeah. And then there was a substantive critique, which is that I do think ultimately there were. The core economic thinking inside was more that we need to jolt the economy back to 2008. There was a belief among many that the infrastructure ultimately was more about Congress wanting to bring things back to their district, even though in what I think is an incredible and underreported act of statesmanship, there were zero earmarks. So I think there were those who said, well, it's right now. Some of this stuff will take 2 or 3 years. We need shovel ready. And I think for some of us, we were saying – yes, but we're not going to be out of this in 12 months. This is a much deeper recession and a deeper problem. So we need that second wave built in so that we don't come back 2 years from now still having this.
When you voted on it and it ultimately passed with no Republicans in the House and only a few in the Senate, in that moment, did you realize that it wasn't going to be this, you know, widely praised piece of legislation that would propel you to reelection?
No, I don't think we... any of us really imagined that this was locking up re-election with this vote. I think we thought we were preventing a depression.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It would be one thing if the stimulus was the only major issue that you confronted upon entering office, but you then had financial regulatory reform, you had the issue with AIG, you had cap-and-trade legislation in that first year or so, and I'm wondering...
July 4th weekend.
Yeah. Well, I have a theory that the cap-and-trade bill was the most difficult one, or the most consequential one for you in terms of politics. Is that fair?
It was an incredibly influential year. If you're going to pick 2 years to be in Congress, those were definitely the 2 years to pick. And the vote for cap and trade was one of the first ones where I would say I was not only casting a vote, but part of the conversation, part of shaping it, part of encouraging others to walk the plank with me for what was seen as a politically challenging vote. And then going out and selling it. And I think that was, for me, the most interesting part of that bill was actually the combination. The stimulus didn't have nearly as much of the stuff as I would have liked on research and development and infrastructure, but there was definitely stuff there.
Yeah.
So our feeling was that this isn't just about passing the cap and trade bill. This was about going out every weekend and spending time with farmers literally in the muck talking about whether you could turn cow manure into power and then bringing in the money and the grants to do it. And we did that. And I think sometimes if I have a critique of Democratic and liberal establishment, it's that we want the technocratic fix that's brilliant and then and just want people to be smart enough, quote unquote, to figure out how brilliant it was for them. And the fact is sometimes it's not that brilliant.
Back to the cap and trade bill. I mean,
yeah.
It's so complex because it was done on the House And there was no guarantees, obviously there wasn't, that the Senate would ever take it up, and they didn't. And it put you out on a limb, basically.
Sure.
It was a very tough vote for you, obviously. Your district, you know, it has jobs that were going to be affected by the bill, and clearly it was politically problematic. So talk about what was going through your head as you voted for it.
I think that I can give you the unfair answer, but it's true.
And sure.
The unfair answer is there was no way on the biggest existential threat to humanity and the planet that I'm going to actually consider that a tough vote in the end of the day. And it was designed in a way that was incredibly soft on, among other things, the coal industry. The coal industry actually would have done far better under cap and trade than it's done in the absence of it, because they were able to build in so much transitional support as well as clean coal technology support, whether or not one believes in that. And the fact is, it was, again, a very kind of Republican free market approach. I probably would have supported a tax shifting mechanism of a payroll tax to carbon tax, you know, something in there. I think there are a number of reasons that can be cleaner as a matter of incentive and policy. So, yes, it was seen as extremely difficult politically, but I'll tell you the happy end of the story, which is there was a poll run on Election Day asking who do you trust most on energy issues. And in a heavily Republican district where they hit me heavily on cap and trade, I won that issue by 24% over my opponent. So I think in the end of the day, I don't actually believe, and there's data to back this up, that it cost me.
What were those conversations like? What were those where you would go out to a farmer in the muck and talk to him about how to convert, I guess,
cow manure
into energy?
The great thing about it, of course, is that people are a hell of a lot smarter and more creative in their thinking than people give them credit for. And they know stuff that I don't have a clue about, right? I mean, one of the most enjoyable things that happened was we brought Secretary Chu down to meet with
– the former energy secretary.
Right.
Yeah.
And Secretary Chu is not a politician. He is not someone I'm guessing who has spent a lot of time farming or hunting in Southside Virginia. And so there were people who were like, I don't think this is going to be a good match with him going down there. And he started to geek out with these guys like you. I mean, farming, these guys all go to Virginia Tech. They're incredibly, you know, creative, the mechanic side of it, whether or not you have the degree. And they just started geeking out on this stuff about the angle. Oh, did you try this? Did you try that? And it was just really fun to watch.
I mean, you had nothing to say.
I haven't. I just smiled for the camera.
You're like, I brought you together.
Yeah. And, you know, and he was then able, because he had the credibility and they had the credibility of knowing their craft, so to speak, to be able to really then get into what the bill does. And people understood the basics, which is that we spend an awful lot of money at the tank and it doesn't stay in the community. And this went to the next level thing, which, you know, George Packer picked up on, which is this guy with the truck stop and trying to make biodiesel where, you know, he figured out that you go to the pump, one of your biggest expenses all week in a very poor community, and 93 cents of every dollar immediately leaves the community. Can that really make sense? And that's when you get into a really creative thing. And I think that was the missed opportunity. I think we did the beginning of a true transformation of something that could radically and positively transform the job situation here with a new energy economy. And we kind of took that step out and didn't.
That was something that I was really curious about, because it's like you're asking people to not only accept this new cultural shift, but it's a cultural shift. It's not that your town isn't going to be centered around the factory anymore. It's going to be around these smaller 10-person jobs, these green jobs that you're talking about.
Well, and it's relevant now because I feel like we're going through a debate about things like driverless cars that reminds me a lot of the NAFTA debate from the 90s, which is, oh, it's going to be great. All those people who used to make furniture will become computer programmers. And no one bothered to ask whether they actually want to be computer programmers. Some people really like to make things with their hands, or some people may not have the ability to go have the same skill set or space to get that make that transition. So with something like the locally grown movement is very different than the idea of a 10-person, you know, boutique tech shop, right? If you pitch it as organic farming, it sounds very elite and snooty. If you talk about locally grown farming, it's something people can understand when you're adding up the value chain. But the fact is, it's complicated, and this is ultimately part of what I walked away frustrated with myself about for those 2 years is the question, do we have an answer? Do elites in particular have an answer to what's driving inequality and joblessness in the United States? And I think, we really have not fully grappled with how deep that runs.
But I think that you were close to that answer. I mean, you had done what a Democrat was supposed to do. You brought these sort of stimulus jobs, millions in grants, towards the future economy as opposed to trying to revive the old economy. And it was interesting in contrast when you think about what Trump is saying now. It's like, well, they're just bad deals. I'm going to make better deals. I'm wondering, like, what do you think that you were close to figuring it out? And what was the feedback you got from people in the community?
I think results matter to people. And I think for a while we were getting enough momentum that it was starting to break down the skepticism. And frankly, people have good reason when they hear an idea is coming from Washington to say, prove it. And I think we were in the 5th District.
And then came healthcare reform, which was not as simple as we can bring jobs here and so on and so forth. It was a complex restructuring of the healthcare market and the insurance market. That must have been grueling, the year plus that it took to put that together. And I'm guess
if I don't even remember that.
You don't remember
that?
Me blocked out?
There was a thing. What was it called?
What was the pressure like from your party leadership to get on board that bill?
The debate was one of the most intense things I've ever lived through. I didn't feel it primarily as leadership from the top. I do think that the House leadership was incredibly impressive in a number of ways. And people have to remember, yes, Speaker Pelosi was and deserves credit for being the chief among chiefs, but it was really a troika of her and Hoyer and
Waxman.
Clyburn.
And Waxman too, yeah.
Well, certainly on the bill.
Yeah.
And people always wondered if, how tough the showdowns were with Pelosi. I was like, the call you didn't want to get was from James Clyburn.
Really?
Well, he was the
whip at the time.
Son of a preacher.
Yeah.
He was part of the struggle back in the day, but
Did you get one of those calls?
We had conversations. I mean, generally speaking.
What were they like?
This confessional.
No, I think that the nice thing about the leadership, which was the biggest surprise, and then I will sort of answer your question, was I expected to have no access to leadership as a first term congressperson. And it was unfiltered access. I was shocked. And part of it is they're good at what they do. Speaker Pelosi had a breakfast every week, and it was a real substantive one, giving feedback from the freshman Hoyer and Clyburn were both extremely available when needed. Clyburn came down to my district and knows, having come from South Carolina, some of the dynamics that I was facing. So, the fact is they never lost a vote. And those included some very difficult votes coming down the stretch. I think that part of what I was trying to figure out at the time, and I still don't have a good answer because luckily for my soul, I wasn't in there very long. But what is it? How good does a bill have to be to vote for it? So I think there are two, questions that everyone from academics to people who've actually served ask. One is, should your vote reflect your conscience or should it reflect your constituency? And the second is, how imperfect does a bill need to be before you can vote? Before you vote for it or against it. And those are, they're essentially judgment calls. Obamacare was I voted obviously the first time for one with a public option in it, which I think was a much stronger bill. At what point, is the bill good enough?
Well, when it comes out of the Senate, and Scott Brown's elected, so now they have to basically go with the Senate bill, right, which doesn't have the public option. Just want to set this up for the listeners. And it comes to the House, and I remember this, that the question before the House was, do you suck it up? But, right? I mean, that's more or less. Like, do you swallow your pride and take what many thought was a half loaf? And I don't think it's been sort of discussed what those conversations were like in that specific moment from people like Representative Clyburn. But I'm guessing he was persuasive. You voted for the bill.
Well, and in that case, I got a conversation with the president, and I think one of the things that people appreciated about my approach was I never went into those conversations looking to horse trade. It was not, hey, you know, if you give me this visit to my district or whatever. It was substance.
You didn't want the Nebraska kickback, whatever the hell was,
no,
that was.
I think it was the Cornhusker.
The Cornhusker kickback, right. The Charlottesville. Well, I mean, we can think of something like that, yeah.
You know, and I think that people, I don't know what he would be like in a conversation where it is about that. But with me, you know, these are deeply serious people who are willing to talk about the bill. You know, it's, you know, there was a question of whether, if not the public option, could there be sort of a Medicare plus 10 kind of buy-in, sure, for people of 50, et cetera. And I think with the ACA or Obamacare, there is a pretty credible argument that says once you get the structure in place, there are lots of ways to build improvements into it with greater consumer protection for patients and against price gouging and other things. We've just got to change to a different structure. And, you know, that'll be tested here over the next 10 years or so.
Was that the argument that won you over, or was it this is history and you won't get another bite at this apple, or both maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I was, as I said to my constituents many times, I am trying to get to yes on this bill. I wanted to support healthcare reform. I think we did worry, some of us, that it was such a complex system and that without some of these bright line rules there, that it was going to be leave a lot to the implementation. But obviously that continued.
What was the case Clyburn made to you specifically?
He wants to know about this Clyburn
conversation. I wanted to yell at you, or –
That wasn't – I don't actually think that was on the the ACA bill. I think that – I'm trying to remember now.
Seniority, like I've been
the figure
forever
of him looms large, yeah, yeah, more than the substance of the conversation. But, if you know,
he
he
was evoking a lot of the civil rights era stuff when he was making the case for the ACA. I wonder if that came up.
I think one of the arguments he made to me that I remember, I think we were – I was trying to force something later, and he just laughed at me. He was like, Tom, do you think for one second I think you're not going to support this bill? I think it was about the DREAM Act or whatever. And all I was trying to do was to get a pledge from them that the Senate was going to move on it, not because I wasn't going to support it, but because the Senate – you know, slept on like 400 of the bills that we had passed. And he had read my
he called your bluff pretty badly. So shortly after the ACA passes,
leading up to that, there was still pressure. You were getting phone calls every day, emails, robocalls, like leading up to the vote. Did you feel pressure from the other side, the Republicans, or from people in the community in various parts of Virginia to vote against it?
Yeah, I mean, your last question was more of a Beltway question, and I gave a Beltway answer. But in the real world, it was. But in the real world, it was incredibly intense and personal. It was brutal. And I respect and believe that many of my constituents genuinely thought this was going to be the death of the Constitution and the death of their health coverage and as they knew it. And there were others for whom this was life or death for it to pass. There were people who'd been working 30 or 40 years organizing to get something like universal health care. And then this was, of course, at the point when the Tea Party had really started to take root. And, you know, it was a lot of vitriolic racism. I was getting spit on. My staff was getting kicked. We were getting calls using the N-word every day. People were very comfortable in, you know, very professional settings saying, you know, there's nothing for white people in this bill. Why are you supporting it? There was not subtlety, which is not to say that there were not people who obviously raised genuine substantive concerns about the bill. But it was, I mean, we're talking about like veins popping out of the neck, vitriol.
How do you respond to that? I mean, I don't even know what you would say to the person who's like, where's the shit for white people? Or even getting spit on. I don't even, how do you even,
yeah, well,
how do you not take a swing at the person that spits on you?
I've done a lot of work on conflict resolution and transitional justice overseas. I never quite thought I would be applying those skills back home, and it was really it was sad. It takes a lot of reserve. So one of the things we had to do, of course, this got pretty well documented. We had called these town hall meetings, one in each of the counties, which meant we were doing either 22 or 24 of them.
Yeah.
And we had to basically start employing conflict resolution tactics. And the first one we had to do was simply say, I'm not leaving till everyone's asked their question, which sounds really simple, but these literally averaged 6 hours in length. So we did over 100 hours that month. And we, you know, in a situation like that, cutting someone off or trying to limit anything that that makes a person feel like they're somehow being victimized or silenced is escalatory. We knew there were people with guns, and these, you know, this is part of the country I come from. And, you know, of course, to their credit, the vast majority of people stepped up to the plate and were substantive and relatively civil. But these were intense. These were intense events.
Did you have to train your staff in conflict resolution, too, to not sort of act out or to not blow off steam at some of these, you know, folks when they get the vitriol that, that you maybe aim for you?
Yeah, I mean, we had to look at exits and go over exit plans and options walking into scenarios. We had to change several venues. And unfortunately, of course, part of what happened with this, well, again, I'm very glad we did it, is that within the first two, anyone who might actually be an undecided person who simply wanted to learn more about the bill didn't show up. Right. The only people who are showing up to that are folks who are there to make a point on one side or the other. I drank a lot of Diet Dr. Pepper. we would go – I remember anyway, that's probably not a great story for now. But the so it was an important thing. And here's an interesting tactical question. So on the one hand, the town hall meeting is sort of the ultimate example of American democracy at its most grassroots level. Who would have thought you would have 1,200 people showing up for a six-hour discussion about Obamacare? Back and forth over an entire month. So in that month, I think we figured out was, you know, 15,000 people or something had attended events. That's a massive number for a single district. We then went back and did a teletown hall where you dial directly into people's homes on it. And we had over 15,000 people there with nobody yelling at each other. A vast majority were people who were undecided because you'd simply caught them at dinner and they were interested. So you know, on the one hand, I think I owe it – a representative owes it to their constituents to go back. But it's also true that part of, I think, creating a civic space is making sure it's not just the loudest voices that you hear. And the loudest voices, the people who feel most entitled to speak up and speak up loudly tend to be white men. So it's not uncommon that you will go into a situation when I didn't – before I really got smarter about this and be like, oh my goodness, every one of these business owners is against this bill because five people spoke up against it. And then they start coming to you afterwards and it tends to be more the women business leaders and people of color who were like, I didn't want to speak up there, but just so you know, this would be great for our business.
Were you afraid that you were actually creating a forum for the most angriest guy to, like, intimidate everybody else? Because, like, you would have people coming in afterwards saying, like, hey, this is not so bad.
Yeah, and we designed a pattern. Again, this is based somewhat on the work I do overseas too, right? You don't want to be a diplomat that goes and just meets with the president and just meets with the head of the opposition. You want to meet more broadly, right? And same thing here. So in those days, from 7 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon, I was meeting in other forums. They didn't get the attention. They didn't get the cameras. But you were going to the hospital to meet with the nurses. You were meeting with small business owners and others. And then the cameras come in at night and catch that part.
I mean, this was all very serious. But then it takes an even more serious turn with the incident with your brother, where I believe it was a propane line was cut off after his address was posted on some Tea Party forum. What was that like?
Surreal is the only word that can describe it. They said, let's take the fight to Tom's house, but then couldn't get my address right, so put up my brother's address. He had four young kids at the time below the age of 10. They're a little older now. And he's a high school teacher and coach. And that night before, all the outdoor lights were stolen. And this has never been solved. So, you know, didn't know what to think of that. Came home the next day between teaching and coaching, and the house was full of gas, and the line was cut, and the investigators still don't know, but they certainly went out and investigated who had done such a thing. It's not a neighborhood where such things happen often, or that's a crime that necessarily makes sense. But we can't know. But it was Capitol Police, everyone else came down. Fox and MSNBC and everyone's at the end of the driveway filming the house. My sister-in-law's joke.
How'd you find out about it?
If they can ever sell the house, they can say, as featured in the New York Times, because the picture was in the New York Times. My brother was calling me at one point the next day. He's like, I never thought I'd say this to you, Tom, but my daughter just threw up on the FBI agent in my house because of your job. It was obviously serious.
How'd you hear about it?
I heard about it from him.
He called you up?
Yeah. And it was still sort of processing. He's like, I'm sure this is not, it was that spidey sense of something really weird's going on here. Incidents were starting around the country. One of the most interesting caucus meetings that I was in was right about that time when all these incidents were starting to pick up. And they brought us all together and kind of went through some of the MOs about how to respond when death threats and other things come in. And, some of the leaders said, obviously they get death threats all the time, so they're used to it, and here's the protocol. And there was this process, I think, with both leadership, other than Clyburn for obvious reasons that I'll explain, and the police of explaining, you guys aren't hearing us. And this was coming primarily, I think, from the African-American caucus, the Black caucus. Which is the difference between, and this is something, we track overseas in here too, the difference between one-off things and the issue about where a culture of violence or lawlessness or vigilantism is being slowly validated. And that's a very different space, right? That's what you saw during the peak of the civil rights movement, was that there were credible establishment white figures who were validating the idea that something was happening outside the law, therefore people needed to take things into their own hands. And I think there was sort of a light bulb moment, I think, for some that this was not just the idea that, oh, there might be a crazy guy who did this, that this is something we'd seen before. And again, I think it's obviously was a scary time for everyone involved. And, it was a time where most people in the Virginia delegation, with one exception, on the Republican side, were very clear and wanted to come in, and we were trying to get people to just simply make more responsible statements.
Who was the one exception?
Yes,
Mr. Cantor.
I'll leave his confessions to another.
We've tried to book him for this podcast. So this happens, and all the while your reelection campaign is ramping up, right? I mean, and was there a sense of this is just too many issues on the docket? I'm being overwhelmed by it all. I can't have enough town hall or teletown halls to convince enough voters. Maybe one issue I could do it, but not three. Do you get a sense of fatalism about your campaign ever?
No, I think we had such a clear sense of what we were trying to do, and I think the team that came together, yes, I was the principal, so to speak, but it was really a team that understood. The first campaign wasn't about winning per se. It's not like I had dreamed of being in the House of Representatives. It was about testing.
Oh, stop.
I thought that was a dream. Yeah, I mean,
universal dream. Go ahead.
There's children's books based on that concept.
No, it was about testing a theory of change. And at the time, there was a presumption that districts like this couldn't be won. And if they were going to be won, it was by trying to run a Republican light campaign.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of us that were sick and tired of that. And we thought that it denigrated the constituents themselves, who were smarter than that. And they care about conviction and they understand that the system is rigged. So it was never a question about selling out in the first campaign, because what would that have gotten me? A House seat as another person in there with like a, mushy whatever message. So it was built into the structure of our team and our strategy that we were trying to test what we called conviction politics. And in many ways, the reelection was – then the next question was, could you legislate with conviction? And then the next question was, could you get reelected with conviction?
As the climate got worse, more or less, with these issues weighing down the party, was there ever, an impulse to moderate yourself or to soften your image or to maybe tack a little bit to the right ideologically in a way that could present yourself more softly to the voters of the Fifth.
I mean,
yeah, it was endorsed by the NRA.
I know. I want to get to that, too.
It's,
yeah.
It's in bold in our questions here. So.
So ask your questions.
Well, hold on. My question first was just, was that impulse there? I mean, was it hard to fight?
I think that I'll give you an example that happened. You were saying earlier that you thought cap and trade was the killer for me. I think for many people, it was the combination of cap and trade and healthcare. There were people who said, you know, I didn't agree with you on cap and trade, but I respected your vote. But then when you did healthcare too, it started to feel more like you were representing Nancy Pelosi than us. I respect that sentiment. Voters are smart. They're going to draw their own judgments. But I think that, you know, that cumulative effect can be a lot. And the, you know, part of it too was the question of the votes that come in front of you and what opportunities you have to do that. I mean, to me, part of what I didn't buy was the left-right spectrum as it had been defined in the 1990s.
Yeah.
So in my mind, going for a bigger stimulus, which is what I wanted, was not something that was more left. It was just more Main Street.
But certainly there were elements in your district, the politics of your district, that were pressuring you here. And so the NRA endorsement in that context, you know, that was a huge get for you, right? Because culturally, very significant institution. Certainly it would have been terrible if they campaigned against you from a political standpoint. But here you are as a sort of, you know, progressive hero, and now you're, you know, touting the NRA endorsement. It seems like, you know, there's a contrast there somewhat.
Yeah, I think that – and I think the politics of gun safety has changed a lot in the subsequent years, and some of that is based on the NRA has a very clear policy. If you are an incumbent and you vote with them, they will endorse you. And part of what's fascinating – you should talk to them sometime – was how much they got backed into a corner, in part by the Democratic leadership's refusing to bring up any votes that were NRA votes except one that had to do, I think, with concealed carry in national parks or something. So by limiting the number of times that many of the Democrats who wanted that endorsement or might think they benefit from that endorsement – and again, I think those politics have probably changed you know, the fact was, and I'd be the first to admit this that, you know, had a different set of gun laws come up, it would have been a different situation. I mean, it's not like I wouldn't have supported the Toomey Manchin, you know, bill if it had come up, and then you're not getting the NRA endorsement. And so it was some smart politics. And the NRA, to their credit, was good to their word on that, and they took a lot of heat. You can imagine there were an awful lot of NRA members in the district who were pretty displeased to see that blaze orange
postcard. Your opponent being one of them,
showing up in that way.
But had you been running in 2014, what you're saying is you never would have gotten the NRA endorsement.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's fair to say for a variety of reasons about the votes that were presented.
In the end, you know, maybe what hindered your reelection chances was just that you had a D next to your name, and it was a terrible year for Democrats.
I always believe that things are my fault because I'm Catholic, but in this case, I think there's a fairly compelling argument for that. In fact, you know, one of my favorite stories from this time was it was my lame duck period. I had lost, but I was still in office, and I was driving down 81 actually, and pulled into a McDonald's. And this guy came over and he was like, I just want to shake your hand. And I said, thank you. He's like, I just never thought I would meet an honorable politician, a person that, you know, that I could really respect. Would you mind shaking my son's hand and taking a picture with him? And because I just want him to know that there's still good people out there. And so the son comes over, and he's about to click the picture, and he goes, oh, by the way, I didn't vote for you. And I said, oh, that's certainly a lot nicer way of putting that than I'm used to hearing, but can I ask you why? And he said, you know, a vote for you is a vote for Nancy Pelosi, and I believe she's a truly evil human being. And, you know, it's – on the one hand, I think you can see that as unfortunate or – silly, but the fact is that's a pretty sophisticated voter because for the most part, if you're sitting in Southern Virginia, whether John Boehner or Nancy Pelosi is the speaker probably has more impact today on the on the agenda than whether Robert Hurd or Tom Perriello is representing your district.
If it's a national election and it's very clear towards the end of the election that Democrats are going to be, you know, overtaken in a wave here, why bring President Obama to your district with a week to go?
I think there were a number of reasons to do so. I think in that case we believed conveniently that our deepest convictions aligned with smart politics. So there were people who felt like those were different and therefore that we were making a statement of conviction and conviction led. I mean, even if I thought it was bad politics, I would have done it. For a lot of people in my district, particularly in the African-American community, there was no ambiguity about what was being done to the president and why. And there's a long history of, if I can be honest, white Southern Democrats throwing them under the bus the first time it's convenient to do so. And I marched with these guys through neighborhoods. We organized. We tried to get people registered to vote. It's one of the reasons why, you know, when conservatives talk about blacks not caring about black on black crime, I'm like, have you ever spent time in these neighborhoods? Yeah. I mean, the number of midnight marches I got asked to do in these neighborhoods. To me it was important because of what it meant to not just many of my constituents, but many of my constituents who had had the least voice and the most marginalization over time. And to be honest, on the tactical side, we needed big base turnout too.
Yeah.
And we hadn't run away from the base, and I think that's why we outperformed so many other races across the country. We hit our win number. We actually hit our targets of what we thought we would need, and the other side just also got their base out, and their base is bigger in my district.
Could an unabashed progressive win in the South again?
Absolutely. Obviously, this is a year of tectonic shifts in our politics, and I think that a lot of the rules are changing. I think for one thing, people are realizing that the biggest group of swing voters are the voters that don't show up. And for years, that was a mythical unicorn in politics. Everyone's like, oh, we're going to be the first campaign to actually get non-voters to vote. I mean, the 90s, the aught years, it was constantly the refrain from the Democrats, and it never worked. And that was in part because I think the Democrats thought the way to do it was to water down good ideas instead of come up with bold ideas.
That happened with Wendy Davis. She kind of watered down some of her ideas and she said it on her podcast. And there was that mythical, all we have to do is get people who don't vote to vote to come out. And they actually didn't at all. Yeah. I mean, it was a disaster.
And I think this is where, you know, again, Trump and Sanders are clearly bringing some of those people into the process. And I think, and some of it is directly structural, right? I mean, yeah. Terry McAuliffe gets a lot of credit for just restoring the rights of 200,000 former felons in Virginia.
So you hit your win number and you still lost. And I'm wondering if part of you is or felt nervous the night of your loss and thereafter that people would take the wrong lesson from it, that they would say, ooh, you know, he was too boldly out there and too aligned with Obama and lost, maybe we shouldn't do that, and maybe we should go back to sort of the DLC centrist model.
The blue dog
model.
Well, in a way, that would have been a good problem to have because it would have meant a lot of the DLC blue dogs had survived the night, but the fact is they got wiped out, which I know there are some progressives that think that was positive, but holding the House would have been a little bit
better probably.
No, I mean, I think it was the nature of the scope and scale of the defeat made that argument a lot harder, and I think the closeness of our race as well. Axelrod was extremely interested and took a lot of time with me afterwards to try to learn the right lessons from the race.
This is David Axelrod, the president's advisor.
And I think they looked at a whole lot of data points from that year in part to make to see that a more populist message going into 2012 was a positive one.
What did Axelrod ask you? You know, when you met with him, what were the questions he had? I'm curious.
I mean, you know, he's a political genius, and he asked all the questions you would imagine about why we had made certain decisions and what we thought the reactions had been and how we thought certain things had played. And, I think we had always appreciated a good relationship with the White House in part because we had taken tough votes, but when we hadn't, we had done so on principle. So we talked numbers, we talked strategy, and I'm sure he did that with 1,000 other people, so I don't want to overplay the conversation.
Sure.
But it meant a lot to me.
Not 1,000, but maybe 434.
I told them to make that Romney ad with him singing. I thought that would be great.
One of the other great moments, actually, in the reelect was this woman came up to me at a 4th of July event. I guess we went up early with some to try to counter some stuff in that summer. And this woman came up to me in her usually happened in reverse gender-wise, where it was the guy being embarrassing. But in this case, she was she spit on me. She said she thought I was a communist. She hated what I was doing to America. I was just fuming and started to stomp away. And then she turned and goes, "Oh, but by the way, I love your TV ads."
Oh, my God.
So we had still run these pretty
fun.
Why
did you get spit on so much?
Was it the spit more of a spray or was it like a loogie?
It was like unclear if it was meant to hit me or not. It was how your older brother sometimes throws darts at your feet, but like to miss intentionally, but still make you jump. Jeez. So it might have been in that in that
That's
space.
So disgusting.
If you had a chance to sit down with someone thinking about running for Congress in a southern state. Who wants to run as a Democrat, what advice would you give him or her?
If there's something you care enough about to more or less risk everything that you have, run and make that the central issue in your campaign, and you can't lose. Because if you do nothing else other than speak to your deepest values for a year, then you've at least made the best case you can for something you care about. If there's nothing you care about that much, you probably shouldn't run, because it is going to require an enormous amount of discomfort on all sorts of levels.
I will say, you do seem, of all the people we've interviewed, probably the most at ease with your loss.
Oh, yeah. again, it was – I think it was not something where I was looking to – I didn't think of myself even at the time as a politician. I thought of myself as a justice entrepreneur who was using politics to test a theory of change.
Sure.
Which really comes across well.
Yeah, but you became this vessel for all these progressives who were like, "Oh yes, you got to do it this way," you know.
But I think that mattered. I actually do think that that was a small ripple in a pond that has helped to reinforce the growth of a movement on inequality and more economic populism. Again, just one small pebble in that. But one of the things about me being in that I realized relatively quickly was that the bar is set so low on authenticity and standing up for your values in politics that you really get graded on a curve. We did become a symbol. And I think symbolism matters. I think that everything from the role of art and social movements to the role of the Batman symbol. There's a reason you come back to these things. Symbols matter, and at certain moments, individuals or teams or campaigns become vessels for that. And I think at the moment, there was a sense in the 2010 race that all these folks had put all their hopes into this new Democratic majority in the Obama administration, and they seemed to see an awful lot of people they had worked very hard for not standing up for that. And I'm really proud that we did, and I'm really proud of what we accomplished, and I don't regret losing at all. Plus, I've had an incredible to me, part of the success story, if you're talking to someone, is look at what it's enabled me to do since then. You know, I've helped be a voice in the progressive movement across a number of issues I care about, voting rights, criminal justice reform, inequality. Right now, I'm helping to support a peace process in the African Great Lakes region, one of the most troubled areas in the world, meeting incredibly courageous Burundians and Congolese each day. And I think that because people seemed to believe that I was coming to this with conviction, they wanted to find new ways to apply that. So in my own small way, I think it's been a success.
That was Tom Perriello on his congressional bid during the Tea Party wave of the 2010 elections. A big thanks, as always, to Christine Canetta, the editor of this podcast, who makes us sound good for the listeners. You can find Candidate Confessional on iTunes or on thehuffingtonpost.com. As I implore you every week, find random strangers on the street Tell them to subscribe. Tell them to rate the show.
It's a way to make friends.
Exactly. So next week, we bring you Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, who is here to discuss his 2012 bid for the White House. I describe it as an emotional tour de force.
I would say if you're jogging while listening to it, it'll fit perfectly because he just talks about jogging a lot.
Exactly. Okay, till then, dear listener, happy trails.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.